All right, well, are you comfortable? These chairs are a little different color than the sample that we got. I like this color much better than the sample that we had. The sample that we got looks like denim, sort of blue jean material. But this, I think, is going to work very well for us. It doesn't exactly harmonize with the carpet, but it'll be all right for our next couple of years until we can get over in our new building. It's going to be much nicer. We don't have all of them in yet. I think we got about 470 of the chairs in, and the ones that we have yet to get are the rest of the ones that have the book racks on them. So back in the back, you may have hymn books in the seats themselves. Let's be careful with these new hymn books. We don't want to get them torn up before we get the new book racks in. And I guess we'll eventually get it worked out to whether you get the hymn book from the chair in front of you or whether you get the hymn book from the chair that you're sitting on, or we'll have to work all that out. I'll let Brother Kersup take care of all the logistics on the chairs, okay? But it sure is nice to have the new hymn books and the new chairs. We're just really thankful. You know, when we first started that project, I know a lot of people probably thought, boy, I don't know if we can do this or not, $18,000 extra dollars on top of everything else. But we're going to make it. We're close to having them paid off, and it's coming right along. And folks, that's just one of many, many such projects that we're going to have to be involved in the next couple of years. You know, the more equipment that we can get and have paid for before we move into that building, the better off we'll be. And we've got a lot of stuff we've got to get in the future, so it's just going to be constant sacrifice. Now, we're talking about humanism here in our class. We're talking about a number of things that I trust will be a help and encouragement to you. Somebody will get this mic for me and put that away. But the session where we are right now is the Humanist Manifesto 2. Anybody need a handout today? Anybody doesn't have a handout, somebody come get these and get them to the people that don't have them. Here we go. Y'all can distribute those accordingly. Just keep the extras for now. But the Humanist Manifesto 1 is in a booklet right here like this. So you can pick it up at a bookstore if you're interested in it. But Humanist Manifestos 1 and 2 are in here. Now, people see these. Hey, there's Tom and Dar Reach. Good to see you. People see this and they say, well, so what? Well, so what is the fact that they articulated their position, and you can see how this agenda is being met. When the people who articulated this position in 1933, the Humanist Manifesto 1, wrote it down, a lot of people might have thought at the time, well, so what? Just a few guys is what they think. But now it has become the national religion. Same with the Humanist Manifesto 2 and the Secular Humanist Declaration that we're going to see in a few minutes. And the main thing that I want you to understand is how it is affecting our nation. I personally believe that humanism has helped to pave the way for the New Age movement, and that there are some similarities in that they're both anti-Christian, anti-God, but there is a lot of difference. Humanism tends to be atheistic, whereas the New Age tends to be superstitious and falsely religious. Interestingly, in the recent edition of Time magazine, some interesting New Age material here. Now, Time magazine's a liberal news magazine anyway, but this particular one has all kinds of ethical and pseudo-spiritual issues in it. The cover story is The Right to Die. And here's the story of a poor young girl who's been unconscious since May of 1987. And you know, that whole business about the right to die, death with dignity, all that business, it's in complete harmony with this New Age philosophy of oneness with the earth, and it doesn't really matter anyway, and if we're going to be coming around again, if we're going to be reincarnated, then what difference does it make? We shouldn't have to live in a suffering body and all that kind of thing. You know, this animal rights business. I was thinking about that a lot this week and reading an interesting article by Buckley in his magazine. If you get all involved in animal rights and you believe that animals have rights, then what are we going to do about the animals' disregard for each other's rights? Huh? Maybe that's something that we can do with our military now that communism is no longer a threat. We can charge the military with the responsibility of protecting the animals from each other. That'd be significant, wouldn't it? Have you ever noticed the veiled anthropocentric view? What I mean by that is that they still hold man in higher regard, even in that animal rights movement. We tend to be more concerned about those animals which are like us. I mean, the warm-blooded ones. I mean, it's the dolphins and the whales in the sea, not the other fish, right? that deserve our concern and respect. Isn't that right? I mean, this whole thing is so absurd. But anyway, here in this, and then of course there's an article in here on Satanism. Cardinal, what's his name, O'Connor, who provoked controversy by saying that rock music promoted Satanism. And then the last article talks about how Egypt is planning on making a little money by making a religious, tourist attraction out of Mount Sinai. And but the interesting article is this two-page ad here. Now, this appeared in a European newspaper a couple of weeks ago, and it's in papers all over the world right now. This is the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. He was very popular back in the 60s. I guess he's getting short on cash, or maybe he needs a new Rolls Royce. I'm not sure, but he's gone commercial again. And alliance with nature's government. He says here, here is a beautiful, unique, and unprecedented opportunity for every head of state. I invite the leaders of the world to examine this offer of alliance with natural law in the light of latest discoveries of modern physics, the discovery of the unified field of natural law. And he's talking about his master plan to create heaven on earth, reconstruction of the whole world, inner glorification of the inner life, Maharishi's transcendental meditation, and so on, his Vedic science, and then the outer, glorification of the outer life, building ideal villages, towns, and cities, creating global green revolution, achieving global eradication of poverty, realizing global, notice this global business. That's a buzzword for the new age. Realizing global rural development and urban renewal. Achieving economic balance in the world family through Maharishi global trading. That's an interesting term. Okay. Achieving ideal education through Maharishi's Vedic science, which offers the fruit of all knowledge to everyone. Achieving perfect health, coherence, harmony, and balance in nature. Invincible defense for every nation. Achieving perfect government. Achieving the rise of a supremely nourishing power in the world. This is Time Magazine, this week. You know? Now somebody says, "Aw, Pastor, he's all hung up on this stuff." Well, there it is, folks. It's everywhere. Can we pass this around? You want to see this? It's the paper clip here. Now don't sit here and read this magazine, okay? But if you want to look at this ad, there it is. It's just, there it is. Now, you know what? This guy is just preaching Hinduism. He's a Hindu missionary is what he is. And it's taken our country by storm. Yes, sir?
Notice his appeal to science.
Oh, yes, there it is. The appeal to scientifically demonstrated principles, he's saying here. And it seems to be so fascinating. Well, that's why you and I need to study this. Folks, it's everywhere. I have subscribed to something. Dr. Hinson gave me a little newsletter called the Psychoheresy Update by Martin and Deirdre Bobkin. I've subscribed to that, and I got the back issue. It is fascinating. Oh, it is fascinating. You're probably going to hear me referring to it from time to time. I'll tell you, after reading through some of those things and doing some of the studying that I have, both for this series and some other things that we're studying right now, the temptation is to say, okay, all right, no more counseling. Okay, because, I am sure that my thinking in the last decade has been corrupted. I know it has. And it has driven me to the Word to get straightened out. And I am very, very concerned about all of us who have been into a lot of heavy reading outside this book right here. And I'll tell you, we just really need to be careful. These are wicked days we live in, and the enemy is very subtle. I'm going to be preaching this morning from a passage in Job about how the devil treats his victims. And it's an interesting thing I want you to see. All right, but let's go ahead and talk now for a few moments this morning about humanism, and focus particularly on this Humanist Manifesto number 2. The basic information that we began to obtain last week about the second Humanist Manifesto, remember, in the Humanist Manifesto 1, the term religious humanism was used. When we come to the Humanist Manifesto 2, they're not calling it religious humanism anymore. They're calling it secular humanism. Why? Yeah, so they can teach it in the public schools. Okay? In other words, they have used the idea of separation of church and state to take true Christianity and the truth of the Bible out of the public sector But now they're calling it secular humanism instead of religious humanism because they want to teach it in the government schools. In 1973, a second edition came out. It's called the Humanist Manifesto II. 113 different people signed it from 9 different countries, and then 275 additional people signed it. Some very famous names, some people that you'll recognize. There are a lot of people in the entertainment media. Let me see if I can get you some of these names here. Isaac Asimov signed it. Anybody recognize that name? Who is he? Very popular science fiction writer. Sidney Hook is a name probably some people recognize. Alan Guttmacher, president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Yes?
Asimov has also written a commentary on the Scripture.
Is that right? I didn't know that. Asimov has written a commentary on the Scripture. Interesting. Paul Kurtz, who's the editor of the Humanist magazine. You'll see him around a lot. He's quite the spokesman for humanism these days. Lester Mondale, half-brother of the notorious Walter, who carried one state in the 84 election. Andrei Sakharov. Recognize that name? The Soviet dissident. Roy Wood Sellers, he's the fellow, of course, that wrote the original one. B.F. Skinner. Who's B.F. Skinner? Okay. Conditional response. And basically, he's a psychologist. Much of Skinner's thinking has affected modern psychology, even so-called Christian psychology. Let me see if there are any other names here that you might recognize. Most of these people I don't think any of us would know, but you might. Oh, how about Betty Friedan, the founder of Now? You know what Now is? Okay. Sir Julian Huxley. You know who Julian Huxley is? Sir Julian Huxley it is. Former head of UNESCO. He's from Great Britain. James Rafferty. Anybody recognize his name? That's not Max, is it? Is that James Rafferty is not the same as Max Rafferty. No, I'm not sure if they're any relationship. Okay, well, anyway, these are some of the people who've signed this thing now. So these are the so-called experts. When, you go home and open up your newspaper and take out your Parade magazine, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if you don't read something written by some of these people. It's coming into every home. And if they want to take an expert and put him on a talk show or have him on some panel to tell us what's wrong with the world and how we ought to behave differently, they'll pull on this list here to get some names. Okay, so that's who some of the people are. Now, the Humanist Manifesto 2 is different in its organization. The first one had 15 tenets. We saw those and what they were, and you have them there in your handout materials. The second one addresses 5 broad categories or areas of human concern. Okay? The first one, of course, is religion. I'm not sure how far we got in this. Which one did we get down to? Huh? Oh, we only did the first one. Okay. All right. Religion. And we made several comments about it. Listen to this statement. Traditional religions are surely not the only obstacles to human progress, although they are one, according to this thinking. Other ideologies also impede human advance. Some forms of political doctrine, for instance, function religiously, reflecting the worst features of orthodoxy and authoritarianism, especially when they sacrifice individuals on the altar of utopian promises. You know, in other words, they are becoming very bold in this document in saying that religion and religious ideals, or governments which have been influenced by religious ideals, are the problem. They are the thing which are keeping us from realizing the benefits of the new age. So, their religious view, basically, they reject man's creaturehood. Man is not created, he is evolved, and they deny that man has an eternal soul. Those are the two opinions about religion. Then they get into the area that they call ethics. And the third and fourth tenets are found here. The first thing it does, of course, is to affirm situational ethics. Listen to this. Ethics is autonomous and situational. Ethics, oh, needing no theological or ideological sanction. Ethics stems from human need and interest. We strive for the good life, here and now. The ethical system of humanism is to enjoy this life right now, regardless of what God says, regardless of what God requires. Now, what's the difference between situational ethics in humanism and appropriate response from us? Those two different terms there. Whenever we talk about situational ethics, the tendency of immature Christians is to think that there is a clear-cut, black-and-white command from God on every specific response that human beings are to give. Have you ever seen that? Have you ever heard people respond? You say, well, you know, that depends on the situation. And there are some things that depend on the situation. Not truth, but our response to a given situation. There are times when we apply principles which will require one type of behavior, and then other times when we apply those same principles, they'll require a different kind of a behavior. Now, I've seen people that, you know, for example, if you come up to somebody, you just got a few minutes, I'm back here, back at the door, I'm shaking people's hands, and I come up to you and I shake your hand, I say, hey, how you doing? Now, you say, well, I've got to be honest. You know, the Bible requires me to be honest. I can't lie. I can't apply situational ethics. And so you hold up the line while 300 people who want to get out the door are waiting, and you go into a half an hour explanation of how you really are. Is that appropriate? No, it's rude to the people behind you, for one thing. And it isn't what I was asking you anyway. So it's okay for you to say, well, with reference to the moment, I'm fine. Okay? As far as you're concerned, for right now, in this context, I'll be okay. Or, I'll call you. Okay? Or, great, how are you? Okay? Or maybe even, I'm dying, but I'll make it. You know? Okay? You see what I'm saying? Now, that's not dishonest. That's appropriate behavior. That is not situational ethics. Okay? Now, there is a sense in which you can apply situational ethics there. Maybe you've been under conviction. Maybe you're doing wrong and you're defeated. And maybe you ought to say, Pastor, I need for you to pray for me. Pastor, I need to call you this week. Pastor, I'm having a problem. I'll get in touch with you. But instead you say, great, couldn't be better. That's a lie, you see. Now, there's a difference between situational ethics and a right response at the moment. You see that? You don't have to be inappropriate in order to avoid situational ethics. So don't confuse those two. When the humanist refers to situational ethics, he means there is no absolute right or wrong. His truth, for him, is not based on the Bible. It's based on what the situation demands. That's why we've got classes in our secular universities today discussing these kinds of things and values clarification, and even in our public schools, in our elementary schools, where they're saying that if it would hurt you for me to tell you the truth, and it doesn't matter anyway, it's okay for me to lie to you. That's not wrong. In other words, what's really important is that I treat you nice and that I be nice to you. That they have misinterpreted the golden rule, you see, to say, well, everybody has to be nice to everybody else so they can be nice to us in return. So if I have to lie to you in order to be nice to you, that's okay. That's situational ethics, and that's wrong. You see? They believe in situational ethics. Any further comment on that? Okay? Of course not. Okay? I don't think so. Do you? Well, you got to understand now that they get their basis in truth. They see it differently than we do. In other words, we are submissive to truth and to principles. They are the measure of everything. How it affects, if I'm a humanist, then how it affects me, how it makes me feel. That's what's relevant. And I can be completely consistent in being and treating myself right while I am completely contradictory to all of my principles and values. They think they're consistent. In other words, if I tell him one thing and I tell you something else, I'm being completely consistent as a humanist so long as I'm really trying to get along with both of you. You see, it doesn't matter what I say. My commitment is to human relationships, not to principles. That's their consistency. Okay? Yes, sir. Boy. Pardon. I'm sorry. Yeah, he does what he chooses. Now, that's an interesting thing. Let me ask this, Dave. Now, of course, Dave studied law at Harvard up there, you know, where they really know what they're doing, right? And charge a lot of money to teach it to you. And now here we are. Here we are in a nation where we have laws that, for the most part, have been based on truths. But now we live in a society which has eliminated truths. Where are we headed? Where's that got to take us eventually? Huh? Yeah, it's got to take us to anarchy eventually. Because when eventually, by the time everything has been rehashed over and over and over, and we have eliminated all of the laws which are based on those absolutes, then we're no longer going to have laws. I mean, anything goes, right? The majority's right. Yes, sir. The way you solve legal problems is you put your group in power because whoever's in power makes the laws. That's where it's headed. And that, of course, is totalitarianism. And, you know, it's a lot of interesting implications there. I saw another hand over here somewhere. All right. Well, let's move on then. Get out of my way. Okay. Let me move this thing over before I knock it over. Affirms situational ethics. The second thing, it promotes reason and intelligence with no reference point. Let me see if I can find a couple of statements on that. Reason and intelligence are the most effective instruments that humankind possesses. Why? On what basis do they make that affirmation? What right do they have to make that statement? That reason and intelligence are the most effective instruments that humankind possesses. There is no substitute. Neither faith nor passion suffices in itself. How do people like this, how do humanists define faith? Huh? A blind leap in the dark. In other words, instead of a rational acceptance of something based on evidence, they think that faith is sort of an emotion, a positive emotion. And there's a lot of people that are preaching faith that believe that. People like Schuller out in California. Yes, sir. Oh, yeah, there you go. In other words, once you have determined that reason and intelligence are the only real things that are worth trusting, then the people who have demonstrated themselves to be the most intelligent get to be in charge. How intelligent can a person be who says that, well, what we need to do in order to have peace is to outlaw war? You know? I mean, that's the kind of rational discussion we're having. But reason must be tempered by humility, since no group has a monopoly of wisdom or virtue. Except, of course, us. That's what they mean. All right? They promote reason and intelligence, but they don't give any reference point. Where do you start? How do you determine? Well, it has to be humble. We, of course, know that we're the most intelligent, but we're going to be humble, so you can trust us. That's all they're saying. Then they talk about the individual. The individual. It advocates individual autonomy. Listen to this. The preciousness and dignity of the individual person is a central humanist value. Individuals should be encouraged to recognize, to realize their own creative talents and desires. Now listen to this. We reject all religious, ideological, or moral codes that denigrate the individual, suppress freedom, dull intellect, dehumanize personality. We believe in maximum individual autonomy, consonant with social responsibility. Although science can account for the causes of behavior, the possibilities of individual freedom of choice exist in human life and should be increased. Freedom of choice. Where'd that term come from? You heard that in the news lately? Freedom of choice. It is an undeniable American right for everybody who has the power to enforce it. Yeah. Now, the abortion issue is one of the classic examples of the application of this ethical system. They say we are going to have freedom of choice. And since we are alive and this tissue here is just sort of a nuisance, well, we will exercise our freedom of choice. There's never any discussion of the choice of the unborn baby. A denial of his personhood is there. Now, you know what the logical conclusion of that is. All of the arguments now, we know this, all the arguments that are now being used to abort unborn babies could very easily apply to any other undesirable elements in society, such as the handicapped, the aged, or infirm, or the fundamentalists. Yes. Ms. Christman said that they've tried to pass a law in, was it Washington State, where they would have outlawed feeding Alzheimer's, or however you pronounce that, patients. Well, of course, that's already been done. In Indiana, there was a little Down syndrome child that was born. And so they withheld nutrition and hydration by court order. And you know what that means? They starved that baby to death and didn't give it any water, and it died. They withheld hydration. So they didn't want the baby. It was born. Now look, how do you justify that? Same way. Freedom of choice. Choice for whom? The person who has the power to make it stick. That's who? That's totalitarianism. You see? Yes. Freedom of choice. Freedom of choice means I get to do whatever I want to do so long as I'm not really hurting anybody else who can do something about it. You see? And of course, we maintain enough social compassion to demonstrate that we really are decent people by creating the so-called homeless myth and all the rest of it. This census is going to be interesting. I wonder how many they found last week. Yes? Wouldn't let them enter the... No, I didn't know that. Oh, yeah. Well, see, the people who are in favor of this don't want the homeless counted because they say that there's anywhere from 300,000 to 3 million or 4 million or something like that. This guy who's the biggest advocate, I can't remember his name, Barney, not Barney Frank. What's his name? Mitch Schneider. Yeah. He says, how many is it that one homeless person dies every 45 seconds or 45 minutes? Some ridiculous statistic like that. Now, if that were the case, we wouldn't have a homeless problem in about 3 weeks. If they were really dying at that rate, unless they're recruiting. You see? Now, the whole thing is ridiculous. When you check their statistics out. But why do we need that? Well, the same reason that we need the so-called test tube baby. Now, we have an unviable fetus up to the day before birth. But 2 days after conception, we have a test tube baby. You see the contradiction there? In other words, science retains for itself the right to manipulate and control so that it can be, you know, it's the old rabbit out of the hat magician thing. In other words, we are really in control. This freedom of choice business is based on individual autonomy, which basically says we want to be able to do what we want to do. But it can't deal with man's basic nature, and they don't understand that argument at all. We were on this radio thing here a few weeks ago. I made the statement that the New Age had no answer for the depravity of man. She didn't understand what I was saying. What I meant by it was that there is no explanation in these theories for why man is the way he is. And of course, her response was, "Well, the answer for the depravity of man is for people to be nice to each other." In essence, is what she said. That's the way we overcome it. Never has worked, never will work, because man is a sinner. The only way man can be delivered from his sin nature is through salvation, faith in Jesus Christ, getting a new nature through the regeneration of the Holy Spirit. That's the only way that a man's going to be delivered from that sin nature. All right. So the individual. Then there's the... Oh, this... I'm not even going to read some of this stuff right here. But it declares the right to an unbridled sexual license. The connection is there, just like Rose said a minute ago. In the area of sexuality, we believe that intolerant attitudes, often cultivated by orthodox religions and puritanical cultures, unduly repress sexual conduct. The right to birth control, abortion, and divorce should be recognized. Hey, I didn't put those three things together. They did. And I'm not even going to read some of this. Moral education for children and adults is an important way of developing awareness and sexual maturity. Moral education. The very term implies that there is some basis of morality, some standard on which it's going to be established. How can you have moral education if you don't have any absolutes? If everything is situational, how can it be moral? Huh? How can it be taught? Hey, you know, the whole thing is absurd. What they're saying, they're trying to take the best that Christianity has produced, and they're trying to retain it without God. In other words, the idea is that man has come to the place that he has... Listen, our society, I think, was it Francis Schaeffer in his book on... what's the name of the book? A little booklet, the manifesto. What was it? Christian Manifesto. In his little book on a Christian Manifesto, where he responded to these things, he pointed out that we are now enjoying the fruits of true faith. And that when several more generations have come along, and all of the things in society, the laws, the social mores and all that, grow out of the prevailing philosophies that are in place today, the kind of society that we're going to have is not going to be one that anybody wants to live in, except those who want to take advantage of others and have the brute strength to do so. This philosophy is a philosophy for barbarianism, not civilization. You see? Now, they are claiming that these principles right here produce what is best in man. Well, what keeps us from robbing and killing and stealing and murdering is not the principles of humanism, but the vestigial influences of fear of God in our society. You see? Now, when we totally remove that, it's like taking the organs out of a man's chest and requiring of him virtue. You see? You can't have it. You can't have life without the vital organs. You can't have the kind of life that humanists propose to produce without the principles which produce it. Okay, and then they come to the next one, which is democratic society, which of course is heaven on earth as far as these people are concerned. It ignores the responsibilities of freedom. To enhance freedom and dignity, the individual must experience a full range of civil liberties in all societies. This includes freedom of speech in the press, political democracy, the legal right of opposition to government policies, fair judicial process, religious liberty, freedom of association, artistic, scientific, and cultural freedom. By the way, you know who one of the most popular writers is today? He's a bestseller. A fellow named Robert, I think his name is pronounced Fulghum. I've given some of his books to some people I thought might be interested in seeing these things. Fulghum, is that the way you pronounce it? F-U-L-G-H-U-M. He's written two little books. One was called All I Ever Really Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. Bestseller. What did he learn in kindergarten? Don't hit your friends. Share what you have. Take a nap every day. You know, I mean, just things like that. It's funny. And you read it and you think, this man has tremendous wisdom. He's written another book now called It Was on Fire When I Lay Down on It. And it's a story about this fire department that comes to rescue some guy who's in his house. And he said, where'd the fire start? He said, on the bed. He said, how'd that start? He said, I don't know. It was on fire when I lay down on it. And he was talking about foolish, stupid things that people say. But it's a funny book. About 3 or 4 months ago, maybe longer than that, there was an article in Reader's Digest written by this fellow. And it was, I don't remember the title of it. But the story was of a man. It was him. How his little girl had given him a little box. And in it, it had a little barrette and a little wadded up piece of tin foil and some rubber bands. And just, it was her little box of treasures. And he took it to his office and he put it out on his desk. He looked at it, oh, isn't that nice? He swept it out in the trash. When he got home that evening, she asked him, where's my box? And so here he was out there, you know, in the middle of the night, getting the security guard, going in, going through the trash, trying to get all this stuff back, because what she had given him was love. You know, and here he had disdained it. And it really is moving to read these stories. His books are fascinating. He is an excellent writer. He's also a Unitarian minister. Interesting. In this latest book, he has a story in there about two families. One, a family of Irish Catholics from Detroit, and the other, a family of Polish Jews from Brooklyn or someplace like that. And the young couple falls in love with each other. And they can't go to the rabbi. In fact, there's a rabbi in the family. And they can't go to the priest. One of the uncles is a priest. And they all hate each other. And so they come to the Unitarian. And guess what he does? He brings peace and happiness and joy to both families. And the grandmother gets up and sings the Ave Maria. And the uncle rabbi gets up and prays this prayer in Hebrew. And everybody gives them a standing ovation. What is that? That is the humanist democratic society. And it's written up in Robert Fulghum's book. And it's selling in the tens of thousands. Why? Because that's the kind of society that American people want to live in. One where everybody loves each other and everybody gets along with each other and everybody shares everything they have and everybody ignores the fact that there's somebody out there who'll stab you in the back if you give him a chance. And there's no way to deal with him. You see? That's why people are going to be so blindsided. This philosophy is not preparing people at all for what is going to happen one day. Can you imagine the people who go into the tribulation with this philosophy? What's going to happen to them? The only difference in modern society in the Titanic is that the Titanic had a piano. You know? Listen, I mean, it's sinking. I don't remember where I heard that here recently. But it's going down, and there's not going to be any way of relieving it and finding pleasure. There's not going to be any philosophy that's going to keep these people solid. And it's going to be every man for himself, because they will have destroyed. Listen, this philosophy right here is preparing people for their behavior during the tribulation. That's a tragedy. I think that may be true. Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, because now, now we really are going to have peace. We really are going to have peace. Now, of course, Lithuania wants out. Now, in 1956, we expected the tanks to roll in. But now, our president is saying, come on, Mike. You know, taking your tanks into Lithuania? You know, I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. Well, anyway, let's move on. I want you to... Democratic society, they ignore the responsibilities. They want total freedom for everybody, but they don't deal with the responsibility. Listen to this one. It also includes a recognition of an individual's right to die with dignity, euthanasia, and listen to this, and the right to suicide. It has been within the last 5 years that insurance policies now pay for suicide. Now you think about that. Here's a guy that's got to get insurance policy, but it's got an exclusion. If he kills himself, his family can't collect. Therefore, he better stay on the job and keep making his premium payments. Right? But now, if you get an insurance company to pay, you think about the ramifications of that for our society for a few minutes. The right to a suicide. Oh, listen to this arrogant statement here. We would safeguard, extend, and implement the principles of human freedom evolved from the Magna Carta to the Bill of Rights, the rights of man, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. In other words, they're putting their documents right in there with the Magna Carta. The second thing here, it implies that the majority is always right. There are people in our society today who believe that. That the majority is always right. People are more important than decalogues. You know what a decalogue is? Ten Commandments. Rules, proscriptions, and regulations. So, the separation of church and state and the separation of ideology and state are imperatives. How are you going to separate government from ideology? How are you going to separate authority from ideology? The separation of church and state. See, the big problem that this thinking has is that they confuse the separation of state, of church and state, with the separation of state. I'm sorry, with the separation of religion and life. There's a difference between taking religion out of life and taking oppressive religion out of government. I believe that we ought not to have government sponsored or government established religion. But this modern idea that we have that if it's religious, it therefore can't have anything to do with public life, is the natural result of this of the so-called separation clause. And the separate, listen, in the Constitution anyway, when it says, you know, the guarantee of the separation of church and state, that wall of separation is nowhere in the Constitution. That was in a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote years later. This so-called wall of separation. Congress shall make no law regarding an establishment of religion. I'm still not sure, and I don't think anybody else is at this time, whether that refers to establishing religion or a religious organization. What did they teach you about that in law school? What does an establishment refer to? Is that an active verb, or
they don't even try to resolve that.
Congress shall make no law. They don't even try to resolve it. Shall make no law regarding an establishment of religion. In other words, they cannot make a law which would create a state religion. That was the original intent, I think, and that they can't restrict or restrain established religion. But now we got to the place where any law that would help in any way, tax exemption for churches, is now being interpreted as federal subsidy of religion. Yes? Do you see why that abuse is occurring? Do you see why a principle which you and I might support, we might say, well, I'm for the separation of church and state. You say that to a person today, and you mean one thing, and somebody else means another thing. They may mean, well, I think if it's public, then you got to leave your religion out of it. That's for your private life. That's for your personal life. What was it Jesse Jackson said in this last campaign? Somebody says, do we have anything to fear because you are a minister? And Jackson said, my religious convictions do not control my political agenda. Yeah. In other words, no. Now, some conservative Christians said, or some conservative people that affiliated with him said, you know, we're very concerned about that. And so one of his spokesmen said, well, you can rest assured that Mr. Jackson did not mean to offend anyone, and he won't be saying that again. And the fact that he said it is not the point. The fact that he believes it is the point. I saw a hand back here. Yes. Yeah, that was what, yeah, sure. Our country was founded on the idea of religious freedom. People not wanting to have an established religion forced down their throat, they came to America to establish religious freedom. But now it has been interpreted in our country to mean that America has to be free from religion. And we can't be free if we have religion. And of course, that's always been an argument that's been used down through history, that if there's anything bad or anything going wrong in society, it must be God's fault. More blood's been shed in the name of Christ than any other, you know, all this kind of stuff. You hear that? And that is the problem with establishing state religions. When Constantine made Christianity, so-called, the state religion in Rome, therefore every heinous and wicked thing that Rome did was attributed to Christianity. You can't make people Christians just by, you know, telling them that we are now a Christian nation. And there's been an awful lot of that kind of thing. Listen, a lot of people have been trying to rewrite American history in the last decade or so. The Christian school movement started teaching that, and we're going to see that in a few minutes. One of the ways that humanism has affected our Christian schools is there's a failure to distinguish between the cross and the flag. There's a failure to distinguish between godly, spirit-filled living and character, you see? In other words, we take American values, and we've almost made them into biblical principles. We need to be very careful about that. We're going to get to that. Okay, let's move on to the next one. As far as democratic society, it advocates socialism. Let me see. I've lost my place here. Here we are. Humane societies should evaluate economic systems not by rhetoric or ideology, but by whether or not they increase economic well-being for all individuals and groups, minimize poverty and hardships. We need to democratize the economy and judge it by its responsiveness to human needs, testing results in terms of the common good. That's socialism. But again, we all know that if you took all the money in the world and distributed it equally to everybody right now, by sundown there'd be rich people and poor people. Somebody would find a way to take advantage of somebody else. How in the world are you going to do this? In order for this to happen, just like any other type of communism, you're going to have a police state in order to make it work, because you don't have people who will do this naturally. The next point, it breaks down God-given distinctives in society. The principle of moral equality must be furthered through the elimination of all discrimination based upon race, religion, sex, age, or national origin. Without any regard to moral behavior, by the way, we have to have moral equality. That's why if a person has AIDS, we're not to discuss his behavior. AIDS victims now are handicapped. We're going to get this handicap bill shoved down our throats. Yes?
They also can get Social Security upon being diagnosed.
Social Security benefits now. And Medicare and all the rest of it. Now, who's going to pay for that? Yeah, we are. Well, that's awful. That's awful. You know, it's amazing. Can't discriminate. Can't talk about a person's lifestyle. Why? Moral equality. Anything goes. If that's the lifestyle he's chosen, we now have to have responsible behavior. Let's teach people responsible behavior. Education is the answer. Yes? That's right. And not everybody that has AIDS is guilty of immorality. You're right, that's a good point. I think it's just like the thing about the homeless. We ought to be concerned about destitute people. We ought to be concerned about people who are down and out, who need our help. The Lord was very clear on that, about our love for them and concern for them. What I resent in this thing is not the individual homeless person, and certainly we shouldn't go and kick a bum, you know, today to glorify the Lord. But when they take this whole thing and they make a myth out of it in order to change the thinking of our society, and the same thing's happened with AIDS. You see, we now have this whole mindset, which is a lie, and of course the individuals get caught in the process, and through the media. We now can glorify people that are burning in hell, as though they were still here influencing us. This Mapplethorpe fella, you know, that bilked all this money out of Congress for his pornography in the name of art. By the way, I read an interesting idea today. You know, you can't put up a nativity scene in a public place now, but you can put a crucifix in a jar of urine and call it art and have it funded by federal money. So the answer is you commission an artist to design your nativity scene, see, and put that up on your government property. No, I don't think they'd go for that. But, you know, if you call it art, nobody can touch it. Isn't that right? If it's art, nobody can touch it. But if it's religion, taboo. Can't have it in a public place. Can't have it out there where anybody can even see it. Yep, that's, well, in other words, glorification of the profane. What I was going to say about this Mapplethorpe fellow, he's been dead now for several months. And yet his picture is still in magazines, he is being quoted. He's become a sort of a folk hero among those who have AIDS. Why? Because he beat the system. He got the money, you see. He died of AIDS, and yet this grant was given to promote his art. So he lives on through his creation, you see. Yes, sir? Yeah. You know, I was working out at UPS when Elvis Presley died. And I made a couple of wisecracks about that. Not the fact that he had died, but about some of the responses that people had. I thought I was going to get hurt before that thing was over. I never saw such a reaction in my life. I mean, I wouldn't say that anybody necessarily deified him, although they basically have. That ought to tell you something about the difference in our society there. At least in Russia, they go by and look at Lenin's carcass. But here we got people making pilgrimages to Memphis, you know? Something wrong. The guy's made more money since he's been dead than he made when he was alive. Yeah, is that right? Yeah, something. So, she was talking about the wax museum in London and about who they had made figures of. And she said, among all the world leaders and others there, they had a wax figure of Charles Manson and his crowd. And they had one statue of a guy ready. 20 minutes after his execution, they had him, you know, in place there, all dressed up and... There he was. Boy, that's something. All right, world community, very quickly. Our time's gone. But basically on world community, what they say there, they desire a one world government. We've reached a turning point in human history where the best option is to transcend the limits of national sovereignty to move toward the building of a world community. Who's going to run this? Each person's future is in some way linked to all. That's existentialism. We must reaffirm a commitment to the building of world community. 1973. Are they succeeding? Are they on target? Are they getting the job done? Yes, they are. Declares war obsolete. How nice. The planet Earth must be considered... Oh, wait a minute, excuse me. No, I'm ahead of myself. We believe in the peaceful adjudication of differences by international courts and by the development of the arts of negotiation and compromise. War is obsolete. Yeah, I have somebody tell Gaddafi that. Promotes universal control. This is the Brave New World concept. The planet Earth must be considered a single ecosystem. That means we're all part of the same biological soup. Okay, we all evolved out of the same swamp, and therefore we've all got to get together. It renounces capitalism. Extreme disproportions in wealth, income, and economic growth should be reduced on a worldwide basis. Who gets to see that that's done? Yeah, the people in power, the intelligentsia. You see? Sign up for Mensa, folks, if you want to survive. You see? There it is. That's just pride gone public. Advocate sensible technological progress as though we didn't. And calls for international cooperation. Well, I'm not against any of that. But basically, humanity as a whole is their epilogue here. Several statements are made. We are responsible for what we are or will be. Responsible to whom? Is the question I'd like to have answered. Responsible to each other, to ourselves, to our destiny, our future. Destructive ideological differences among communism, capitalism, socialism, conservatism, liberalism, and radicalism should be overcome. By whom? Churchill made an interesting statement. He said, I cannot be neutral as to the fire brigade and the fire. You know, I like that kind of statement. In other words, he has to make a distinction between the two. How are you going to be neutral between capitalism and communism? How are you going to be neutral between totalitarianism on the one hand and freedom on the other? How can you say, I mean, this whole business... It'd be like if somebody breaks in your house, they're holding a gun to your head, and you get your gun out, and you're holding it on him, and you call the police, and the policeman comes and says, now, boys, put down your guns. You see? Wait a minute. He broke into my house, officer. Yes, but this is not the way to solve our problems. We wouldn't have had a problem if he'd stayed out of my house. You see? That's the society that we're trying to achieve. Here's the two questions that I want to leave you with, and we're going to quit on this for today. Question number one, who's going to rule in this society that these people want to build? Second question, whose kingdom is this going to be? Well, it'll belong to the people, right? Is that the way it's been in Russia? True communism, pure communism. What Marx desired and what he proposed became a totalitarian police state. What they're trying to do is bring in the millennium without the Lord. And it's not going to happen. Not going to happen. Keep it in mind. All right. We're going to look at a couple more things. We're going to see how humanism has affected us in our churches and in our Christian schools. And then we're going to let Dr. Henson come and talk to us about the New Age for as long as he needs to. All right. Let's stand and be dismissed in prayer. Father, I pray you'd help us to be wise and discerning about these principles of humanism and how they've affected us, how they've undermined the truth of thy word. And Lord, especially, I pray that you'd help the people of this church to see how this thinking has even encroached into fundamentalism, into Bible-believing churches with attitudes that will destroy us if we don't uproot them and correct them with the truth of the Word of God. Lord, give us discernment. Help us to see these things and to avoid them. In Jesus' name, amen.